if the study is done controlled and properly, negative data is just as important as positive responses. And sometimes that's a little challenging for graduate students to understand that, no differences. Well, a non-significant difference can be significant many times.
It's time for a new era of communication in the swine industry, one that you can get the latest updates while commuting or driving to farms. Here, you will have the brightest minds of the global swine industry in your pocket. SwineIt Podcast is only possible with the support of forward-looking and innovative companies like Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. NutriQuest, experts serving producers and delivering breakthrough solutions. Genesis, the first power in genetics. Merck Animal Health, driven by prevention. AB Vista, new nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production. Zinpro, essential trace minerals, exceptional performance. EveryPig, a simple yet powerful pig health and production management tool. Gestall, always one step ahead in swine feeding.
Welcome to the SwineIt Podcast Show. My name is Marcio Gonçalves, your host for today's episode.
This episode's sponsor highlight is about Genesis. Genesis is the largest independent producer of high health registered purebred swine in the globe, having over 80% of all registered purebred breeding stock in Canada. The Genesis genetic program uses genomic selection strategies focused on productivity, faster growth, efficiency, high yield, and meat quality. To know more, go to genesis.com. GENESUS.com.
Hello, everyone. Today, we have Dr. Lee Johnston here with us, and we are excited to get his insights on many different areas. Dr. Johnston, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to connect up with you. I've seen you on my screen lots of times, so now I see you again, but now I'm talking to you instead of someone else.
I love it. No, really excited about some of the areas that you are working on, but before that, as always, for folks that never heard of you, we have an audience that's very, ranging across multiple countries. So what, if you can just share with us your journeys so far.
Yeah, I basically grew up on a dairy farm in Western Pennsylvania, and I was in a rural or urban area, town I grew up around us. We milked 100 cows on 9 acres. And all my classmates in high school were town kids, and I was the only farm boy. And I knew that when I got out of high school, I needed to get somewhere where there's more agriculture. And fortunately, I studied at Penn State and did my undergraduate in animal production there. And that's where I was really introduced to pigs. There was a mentor that worked in the swine barn at Penn State at the research farm that hired me. Took a chance. He says, "Well, you're a dairy guy, but I need some help." And he really cultivated my interests and showed me a lot of possibilities in the swine industry. And so when I finished at Penn State, the hog market was fairly depressed, and a lot of people said they wanted to hire me, but they didn't have any money, and I really didn't want to work for free. Mm-hmm. So I had the opportunity to take a position at Texas Tech University as the assistant swine herdsman in the research farm at the university. And Dr. Don Orr, who was on the faculty at that time, hired me and provided me the opportunity to study towards my master's degree while I was there. And that was a really neat opportunity. I was, for folks from the U.S., they would understand I was a damn Yankee living in the South. So I had a lot of free time on my hands and thought, well, I might as well go ahead and study. Mm-hmm. So I earned my master's degree in swine nutrition under Dr. Orr's leadership or mentorship. And then at that time, a master's degree in swine nutrition didn't do much more than a bachelor's. You had to go on for a PhD to really get the jump in position and pay. And so I had the opportunity to study at Michigan State University under Dr. Alan Miller. And Dr. Miller is one of the gurus of trace mineral nutrition and just a fabulous guy. And worked with him, did my PhD there, and had the opportunity to do extension work there in both the 4-H program and in swine industry. That put me in a pretty good position to come here to the University of Minnesota. And I came here in 1988, and I'm located at a research center in western Minnesota. The University of Minnesota system has research centers around the state, and they have pigs here and had cattle and sheep. And I told my wife, well, we'll take a chance. We'll go out there to the prairies of western Minnesota and try it. If we don't like it, we'll take another job and go somewhere else. And now we are in 2020, and we raised our family here, and university's been a good thing for me. So it's been good.
Super cool, super cool. And I mean, you guys have done a lot of work on the DDGs area and others, but let's jump in on something that I reached out to you. The main topic was around water quality for nursery pigs. It's been one area that we definitely want to learn more about. It's one that, you know, people talk about the forgotten nutrient. You know, it's super important. So what have you been doing on this area?
Well, we had some discussion with pork producers here in Minnesota, and the Minnesota Pork Board put in their call for proposal wanting some work done on water quality and how that might affect performance and health of nursery pigs. Some farms were seeing some stalled out pigs hard to start. And after they, you know, exhausted all the possibilities to try to fix the problem, they said, well, maybe it's water quality. And so that was the genesis for the research call. And it was actually on their call for proposals about 2 years. In the first year, we looked at it, thought, God, that's a real can of worms, and how would we really advance things, and kind of ignored it and made some other proposals. But then when it showed up the second year, we said, well, let's try to dig into it. And we had a lot of discussions here about how to approach this and what we could do to contribute to the knowledge base. And where we arrived at was, well, there's the water quality that comes from the source, whether it be the groundwater or the municipal water system. And then there's the water that the pig drinks. And they're not necessarily the same thing, because we've got distribution systems, and that they may or may not be maintained well, and some of those types of things. So we opted to say, let's just deal with the quality of the water that's presented to the farm and see if those parameters on water make a difference to the pig in terms of their performance and health. And then if we find differences there, then we can go further through the system into the distribution system and what happens with biofilms. And the challenge is, these are so site specific. So we thought about doing a large commercial study and looking at a various farm and say, well, why was this one have better performance than that farm, and what's the water quality difference? And there's just a ton of confounding factors. And so what we decided to do was, first phase, try to identify what qualities of water are out there being fed to pigs. And so we did a survey, and Brigitte Lozinski, the master's student on this project, basically, well, she did all the legwork on this, to identify farms that had water analysis. And maybe we asked them, do you think your water is good? Clear down to intolerable. And are you doing any treatments, those kind of things. From that survey, we identified 15 farms through the pig dense area of Minnesota to go to the farm, sample their water, and do an analysis on that water. We analyzed each water sample for 29 different analytes. And the idea was, let's try to find what I'll say is bad water, and then some water that we think is good water, and bring those waters to our research farm here and feed those three different waters. We end up with three, two pigs under the same housing, the same nutrition, the same management, so that we could truly test, did the water make a difference? So that's what we did. And we replumbed our nursery, set up some water tanks outside, kind of big bladders that looked like water beds. And we hauled water in from these three farms. And we took the water right from as close to the wellhead as we could. So it was not adulterated, contaminated, influenced by any treatment systems or any sludge in the distribution system, whatever. And then we brought in pigs, wean pigs, 21-day-old pigs. A lot of them, we had about 450 pigs on the trial. And then we measured about everything that we could think of. Of course, growth performance, you gain, feed intake, morbidity, mortality. Of course, with that smaller numbers, it's a little harder to nail that down. We did indirect digestibility estimates of the diet. We fed the same diet across all the three waters. We measured, did an in vivo gut permeability test with sugar absorption. We did some behavior, put cameras on some of them to say, well, did pigs have some aversion to one water versus the other as maybe a measure of quality? We did some bleeding, just blood chemistry profiles, and then cytokine analysis. And then we did a phago test, a kit to identify phagocytosis in white blood cells of the of those pigs. So that's the suite of measurements we did over a six-week nursery trial. Of course, we did a lot of water monitoring to make sure the quality didn't deteriorate in storage. Bottom line, didn't make a difference. And the waters that we had ranged from like total dissolved solids on the really good water was 348 parts per million, what we thought was the good water. And on the bad water was 1,500 parts per million. Sulfates range from 2 parts per million to 1,120. We had quite a range there,
yeah. But
we could not detect, the pig didn't tell us that there was any difference in those waters. And those waters, it was really hard for us to decide what is bad water. We know that there are guidelines that people, you see the same set of guidelines come up, like for total dissolved solids, kind of the threshold or the guideline is 3,000 parts per million. And for sulfates, it's 1,000 parts per million. And you see those guidelines turn up in a lot of different publications. We traced that back to like the 1970s, and they were kind of derived from human standards. They haven't really been updated, and so we wondered, well, do those guidelines still apply?
Mm-hmm.
But the three waters that we had did not exceed those guidelines, so maybe they weren't bad enough, so to speak, but they were reflective of what water was being fed to pigs in Minnesota. And of those 15 that we sampled to figure out which three we were going to select, we had some that they had softeners on it, they were treating them in the farm. Of course, we sampled before the softeners. Some of the farms said our water is just terrible. Sample ours and put ours in the study. And then, of course, the one said it was, you know, they had really good water. And so basically where we arrived at was that, at least within the parameters of our study, we could not determine any differences in the water within the guidelines that had been published. And so those guidelines probably still apply. And, you know, we'd have to call all three of the waters good because performance was the same.
Wow. Yeah, that's very interesting. And do you have that range in iron, for example? I don't know if you have that handy there or not.
I can, yeah. Give me a minute here. I can pull it up.
Just curious because, I mean, sometimes, you know, when you see, I don't know, you're sharing into a farm and you see they stay on the wall and you're like, okay, well, maybe a lot of iron, But again, it's hard to connect that to performance sometimes, even though I believe, you know, when you have high iron, in theory, you'd have more bacteria proliferation and that kind of stuff. But again,
that's probably true, but we weren't able to measure that because we did it before the water lines, the distribution system. And that's where water might change. Brigitte, the student, when we were starting this study, she'd say, Nali, you know that the water the pig drinks out of the nipple is different than what's coming out of the well. And I said, yes, I agree. And then I said to her, I said, well, do you want to run 2,500 gallons of water into a tank from that nipple in one of those pens after the distribution system? And, you know, we agreed that wasn't practical. And then the distribution system would have variation from farm to farm. And so were you really testing the water quality, or were you testing the water quality plus the maintenance of the distribution system? So that was a challenge. To answer your question on iron, it ranged from the good water, or what I called the good water, 1.3 parts per million to 5.5.
Okay. Do you have the, and I don't recall what the tables would say, what's ideal, do you know?
Well, there's not really a recommend, in our tables, there wasn't recommended iron level, a standard. Okay. Another one that gets, a lot of attention is manganese, and those range from, they were all less than one part per million. We did not have any nitrate problems in our waters, any of the 15 that we sampled, no coliforms, fecal coliforms. So those kind of typical quality parameters weren't an issue. So we're not necessarily saying water quality doesn't matter, but we couldn't pick up the differences under the conditions of our trial. And within the range of waters that we had that appear to be out there, seems like maybe it's not as big an issue as we might think. But then the maintenance of the distribution system certainly is important. And that could change the answer based on how well that's maintained, how clean it is, biofilms. I know when we started our trial, we replaced all the plumbing to these rooms so that we'd have truly test the water. Uh-huh. But we had drink-o-mat cups in the nursery, so there was a nipple inside a water cup, and there's this metal stand pipe that supplied them. So we had to have those, so we had to clean them, and we opened them up. I was embarrassed to say we had a lot of grunge inside there that had built up over a lot of years with, you know, water meds and that kind of thing. So we cleaned all those out too, so that we did everything we could to try to make sure we're testing the water quality and not the distribution system.
Very cool. Yeah, very comprehensive study. On the sulfate side of things, right? I think there's a few studies showing, hey, if you have high sulfates, the pigs get a little loose, but no change in performance as well, right?
Exactly. And there are those studies, and it's like, well, if the pig's loose, is that really a problem? The other thing we talked about in our study was we had a big discussion at the beginning of what was our pig source going to be. Do we want high health pigs, or do we want pigs that maybe are a little compromised or challenged? We chose the high health pigs, right or wrong. Maybe if they were health challenge pigs, you put in the sulfates on top of, maybe there's a different answer. One producer asked me, so, well, the diets you used were commercially industry standard diets, four phase nursery program, pretty good quality phase one, phase two diets. What if you tried to cheat on that and give a little more bland diet, a little lower cost diet? Would you get a different answer? Maybe. But, you know, we talked about it and we knew whatever we picked, it probably is going to be wrong. But, you know, you can only test certain things. And so we were pretty pleased with the way the system worked and being able to feed three different waters side by side. The quality of the water did not change over the 6 week trial. We sampled at the beginning, the middle, and the end. The water quality from the source didn't change because we had we basically had to get two shipments of water, of each water, to get through the whole trial. So, yeah, that's kind of the story there. We're not sure exactly what next steps are going to be. You could think of tons of permutations, but that's kind of where we stand at this point. The student just, Bridget just defended her thesis a couple of weeks ago, so she's trying to wrap things up, and we hope to get this submitted for publication sometime soon.
No, very cool study, and even when we don't find something, it's meaningful, right? I mean, I remember the lysine bioenergy study I did in late gestation, you know, 1,000 cells, 15,000 baby pigs weighed at birth. Well, turns out there was no difference virtually in performance or birth weight, with the exception if we make them fat, you know, we have higher stillborn. Well, turns out that that's a massive conclusion for pig producers, that they're going to save a lot of money. So back to the water quality. Sometimes I think some folks do a little bit of what I guess it's called a precautionary tale, right? What about this? What about that? What about that? Well, here's the data so far, and doesn't seem that we need to worry too much so far, but goes back to water access and flow, I guess, right? What's your thoughts there?
Oh, yeah, certainly. We use PQA standards for water flow. We checked those waters weekly to make sure flow wasn't restricted. We had to do a little tweaking on our system. We had new pressure tanks and pumps for each water source, so water wasn't limiting. Certainly access is important. And I think we had a really good session on water at the Lehman conference, the pre-conference session, and some folks there talked about access and supply. So that's a little bit different issue, but certainly important to make sure that there's plenty of water for liver medications, dealing with heat stress. Just, you know, if we want to restrict feed intake and slow them down, cut their water back, and not a good thing, and has welfare implications and so forth. So, to your point about negative data, if a study is done controlled and properly, negative data is just as important as positive responses. And sometimes that's a little challenging for graduate students to understand that, no differences. Well, a non-significant difference can be significant many times.
Right. Do you think some journal editors also have that problem of rejecting sometimes negative or no response type of data?
Sometimes, yeah. And I've had my share of that kind of data over my career. And fortunately, we've been able to get most of it published and try to make the case that if we did this right, knowing that there's not a difference is important to somebody.
Yes. And I mean, if we look at the gold standard of science, which maybe is a meta-analysis, well, for this to continue to be the gold standard, we need the negative, the non-response one, because if we just publish the positive one, then it's not right.
Well, how many of our colleagues over the years have done literature searches or meta-analysis and that, and there's always these little statements in there about, well, this might be biased because we're only hearing about the studies that this worked, and we don't see the studies where it didn't work. And those are important to balance things out.
Awesome. Let's transition a little bit to the work you are doing on sows and zinc and piglet survival. What did you find there?
The zinc work basically started with an interest in fetal imprinting and the whole idea of what can we do to make piglets more higher survival, more robust, perform better. And if we look at the time when we really started the bigger litters and greater variation in birth weights and low birth weight pigs and losing so many of those, so what could we do? There was numerous attempts at postnatal. How could we deal with those low birth weight pigs with varying success? our thought was, well, is there something we could do prenatal during gestation to set that pig up so they'd be better off after birth and through to harvest or whatever? We kind of stumbled across a paper by Jeff Vallee and his group at Clay Center, in which they fed zinc, I think it was like from day 80 of gestation on, last 30 days, something like that. And they compared 150 parts per million of supplemental zinc to 280 parts per million with gilts, a small number per treatment. The study wasn't entirely designed for zinc, but the thing that caught our eye was in the low birth weight pigs, pigs weighing a kilo or less at birth, they cut the mortality rate in half. So they went from like an 80% mortality rate on those pigs to a 40% mortality. Still high, but notably. So we started thinking about that. They also decreased stillbirths as the birth interval increased. So those longer stretched out farrowings with the zinc feeding, they had a lower stillborn rate. So all those things seem to suggest to us that, well, maybe there's something there that we should investigate, because we weren't aware of anybody else doing anything with it. And so we designed a study to look at this concept on a commercial sow farm. So we had more numbers, multi-pair sows, and we had three treatments. We had their control diet, which is 125 parts per million of supplemental zinc. We had an intermediate diet, which was about 240 parts per million supplemental zinc. And then that kind of matched what the Clay Center group did. And then we said, well, let's go higher. And so we added a third diet at 470 parts per million supplemental zinc. All the zinc, the supplemental zinc, was from zinc sulfate. The control, the base diet, had 75 parts per million of zinc from zinc sulfate and 50 from zinc amino acid complex product. And so to get that extra zinc in, we designed a top dress that the staff at the farm, fortunately they were great collaborators, they put either a quarter cup or a half a cup of this top dress on the sow's feeder boxes from day, what were we, 75, I think it was, 80, through to farrowing. And then we followed those sows post-farrowing. What was the mortality rate of the pigs, stillbores, performance, so forth. And then we also followed a subset of pigs clear through to slaughter. So our idea was, well, maybe we can save those low birth weight pigs, but then if they're a drag on the system post-weaning, did we really gain as much as we thought? So we followed some pigs clear to slaughter. And basically what we found was that zinc didn't really affect farrowing performance. Litter size, 13, 14 born live, 11 weaned in this set of pigs. Prevalence of stillborns and mummies weren't different across zinc treatments. There was a significant effect on the middle zinc level, the 240 parts per million added. There was a significant reduction in the number of low birth weight pigs. So about a 4 percentage point difference. Lower numbers of low birth weight pigs. But the thing that really, really caught our eye was that the pre-wean mortality of these pigs, of particularly the low birth weight pigs, dropped from 38% in the control sows to 28% in the high zinc fed sows. We also saw a similar reduction in the heavyweight birth weight pigs. And that pre-wean mortality went from 7.5% to just over 3%. And we're not sure why that happened. Then when we followed those pigs on, clear through to slaughter, there was no differences in post-weaning mortality, no interaction between gestational zinc treatment and birth weight category for growth rate, carcass lean, any of those things. So basically, if we save that pig, it performs well throughout the system. So we had the work from Jeff Belay's group said that added zinc in late gestation improved preemie mortality. We had our study, and we had about 350 sows on the trial, 4,500 suckling pigs involved in the study, and we see a similar trend. And so then we're starting to think that maybe there's something there. And we have another study, hopefully starts next week, looking at the timing of that zinc. Because as soon as this data came out, some producers said, well, you just fed from day 85 to farrowing. That's kind of a pain in the butt for me to get that in the diet. Can I just feed higher zinc the whole way through? Well, we don't know. We didn't do that. Last week, right before farrowing, when sows move into farrowing, it'd be easy to supplement at that time with fewer numbers. So hopefully we see a similar response. And then we plan to take a lot more samples to try to understand why it's happening. We've seen this. And there's another study out there that suggests that it's there, but we don't know why or what the mechanism is. And so this next study, we're hoping to drill into that. You know, from an environmental standpoint, you'd say, well, feeding a lot of extra zinc is probably not a good thing. And we recognize that. It's maybe not as bad as one thinks, but our idea is if we can understand why it's working and how it's working, then maybe we can get the same response without using the zinc, or we can use a more bioavailable source of zinc to get the same response and minimize the environmental impacts.
Very interesting. And maybe even trying to figure out if you can reduce zinc a little bit in the last few diets before market, just because it's a lot of feed, just so our total amount of zinc maybe will be okay, right? At the same time, there's a few studies from Dr. Chad Polk. If you are using ractopamine, a little more zinc actually helped a little bit there, but most people are transitioning out of that. What I was going to ask you on the, I mean, this is very interesting. I guess what I was going to ask you, Dr. Johnson, is on the average mortality between the treatments. I know you mentioned, you know, by group, but on the combined mortality, was there a difference there or not?
Numerical difference.
Okay.
In overall. The overall mortality, it was basically from 15% in the control to 12% on the high zinc.
Okay.
It was a tendency there. That, statistically, that was a tendency.
Tendency, okay. Wow, that's pretty good. And that's preemie mortality, right?
Mortality, yeah.
Wow.
We tagged all those pigs at birth and had them weighed and then followed those through for those 340 some litters that were on the experiment. So, yeah, and you're well aware of the amount of work that's involved in and keeping all that. But the farm staff was super. We worked with Schwartz Farms in Minnesota, and they've been wonderful partners on this.
Very good, Dr. Jones. So I think transition a little bit into a more philosophical side of things that I like to get sometimes is, is there something that you believe from what could be from our technical area or even outside, but that you believe that many people would disagree? And the reason I like to ask this question is because that's the only way we move forward, right? If everyone agrees on everything, then we're going to be here sitting equally in the next 10 years. So is there something that you believe? And I always like to say historically, when I looked at the data for bump feeding sows, was very clear, like, doesn't sound like it's helping, but it's still up to this day, even though I think we've seen dramatic change in the last 3 years or so, still there are some people like, oh, yeah, we need to give a lot of feeding late gestation. Well, I strongly disagree with that. It just leads to body condition. So that's just some example on my case. But is there something on your case?
Well, yeah, from a technical standpoint, I did work many years ago. Farmers all over will tell you, and one of my best friends is a hog farmer, and we had this conversation just this last week, that when you get new crop corn in, the pigs eat better, they grow better, everything gets, life is good when you get new crop corn. I did, I think, 3 or 4 studies here trying to document that and could not.
Interesting.
I mean, people won't believe my data, but I have the data. And we kept corn that we had from last year that we stored here, and then we had our new crop corn, and we dried it the same moisture, and we did studies where we stored corn at different moistures and then took the new crop corn, and nowhere could I find differences in growth performance, pig performance with new crop corn. But every hog farmer will tell you, pigs do better when you get new crop corn in. These are reputable people, respectable people, so I'm not going to call them a liar, but I can't find that response. The only thing I can think of is maybe our old crop corn just hadn't deteriorated as bad through the years as in bigger commercial settings, but I don't know.
And could that be, I'm thinking out loud here, but could that be in the case of why people might see that in production, is just time of the year, like winter, higher growth rate or something like that?
There's certainly some confounding factors there that are getting being attributed to new crop corn that aren't appropriate, I mean, aren't true effects. But we published the data, we got it out there and said, okay, here's what it is. But it's not something I'm going to build my career on. It's just, we were trying to figure out if that's true, then what is it about new crop corn? And could we do something to old crop corn or mid year to make it perform like new crop? Was kind of the theory going into it. Well, when we couldn't find a difference to start with, then we're kind of dead in the water. So, that's one that I'll go to my grave saying, I don't have the data and I have never seen the data, but everybody will say it's better. And so, okay.
Right. That's super interesting. Maybe like tail biting and salt, because I haven't seen any data on tail biting and salt, but I think a lot of people believe, check salt or sodium if you're seeing tail biting, but I'm not aware of data. I don't know if you know of anything on that arena.
Yeah, we've done some work here with that more from a behavioral and social standpoint. Yushi Lee, my colleague here, has done a fair bit with tail biting, and we have not really delved into the nutritional side of it. But it's so many factors that go in, and people will tell you different things that will fix it. And, maybe it does in that setting, but it's maybe not broadly applicable. So we found some interesting things from the behavioral and social standpoint of tail biting that one wouldn't expect. Whenever she mixed pigs, I think I have this right that there was more aggression and tail biting amongst litter mates when they moved them from farrowing into nursery and finishing than if you mixed those litters up and had different pigs from different social groups. And wow. That didn't seem to make sense to me, but the data were that I think the litter groups would have it all sorted out and be a problem, but that wasn't the case.
Yeah, that's interesting. Very good. One more thing I wanted to ask you, Dr. Johnson, before we move to the 3 questions that I ask every guest, if you could write on a billboard that everyone around the globe would see it, what would you write on that billboard?
I would probably say something like chill out. These times that we're in right now, and whether it's the political climate here in the US or pandemic or whatever, it seems to me just so many people are getting so watered up about, in some cases, important things.
Right.
But a lot of times it's small things, and it's like, take a breath. Is it really that meaningful in the whole scheme of things? And chill out.
I like it. Yeah, I love it. I think I don't watch news very often, but if I do a few days in a row, I start getting reactions. You know,
I'm an old guy, so I'm not a big social media fan, and I'm not on Facebook a lot or those things. But the stuff I hear and a little bit I see about people ranting, raving about this or that, it's like, really, just take a breath and. They didn't necessarily mean to slight you or whatever. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But it's a little bit like my mother used to tell me, or tell my sister. I would always kind of needle and pester my sister. And the reason I did is because she'd get worked up and make a big fuss about it. So you just keep kind of, you know, sibling rivalry. Mother would tell her, don't react, he'll leave you alone. And I think a lot of the cases, if we just kind of chill out and not assume that everything's going to be bad or out to get us, we'll probably be better off. But that's just me.
No, I like it. I was just chatting about this exact same thing today during lunch, which was, back to the pandemic, I like to see the actual data instead of seeing what the news are telling. Like, I'm like, okay, yeah, there's a lot of noise, but I mean, the number of deaths are like plateau, depending on where you are in those things, but you know.
And no doubt it's a serious thing, and it becomes more serious if it hits your family or your loved one, you know. But from a population standpoint, you get a different perspective if you do your own numbers versus what the media is doing and what a lot of other people are telling you. And of course, that's to me a hallmark of graduate school and our training is make your critical decisions on your own and look at the data and be critical in your thinking. And so
it is time to our famous three.
An animal nutrition technology company offering innovative products and new applications for the swine industry. The combination of AB Vista enzymes, technical services, and nutrition expertise provides the industry with new opportunities to further improve production efficiencies. Fiber is receiving renewed interest due to its influence on the microbiome, and AB Vista has brought together research experts to discuss the industry's knowledge of fiber functionality and to introduce a stimbiotic targeted to improve fiber digestion. To request access, contact NAM at abvista.com. For knowledge and news from the global swine industry, access our partner, thepigsite.com.
So the three questions, Dr. Johnson, that we like to ask every guest, the first one is, what's your favorite pig-related book or resource?
Probably Swine Nutrition, the book that my mentor, Ellen Miller, wrote the first one. And I was there in school when he was working on it, and I saw it develop, and then I was fortunate to be able to write for a second version, and that has been I actually have on my shelf back here, I have a signed copy from Ellen Miller, the first version, so that's pretty special to me.
That's awesome. Yeah, great book. I love the way it's written. And cool. And then the second one is, what's your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
I remember in high school, reading the book, and I'm ashamed I can't tell you the author, but All Quiet on the Western Front. It was a book about World War I and some of the soldiers and how they went through the war and what they saw, what they experienced. In one particular spot, this soldier jumps into a foxhole with a dead enemy soldier, and then realizes that that enemy was a person and had pictures of his family and so forth. And that was very influential on me as a young person to realize. And since I've been able to travel internationally some, realized that pretty much people are people. And there's a lot of the same fears and joys and so forth. And that book really, really brought that home to me. And, it's been reinforced in my later years too. So I'd say that that's probably the influential book for me.
Wow, that's cool. And I think many astronauts would say that's what they see from space, you know, not a lot of borders.
Yep.
Very cool. And then finally is, what do you think sets apart successful swine professionals from those that are not?
Well, I was raised work ethic, work hard, be honest, you know, take your licks when you need them, you know, when you screw up, own it, and network. I didn't learn the networking early enough in my career. I was kind of shy, and that's really important. And people want to help you and want to support you. And as long as you're willing to reciprocate and be truthful and deliver what you say. So hard work and ethics. There's an old gentleman in this county that's been very influential. He's passed on now, but he would always say, it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and a day to lose it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if he came up with that or not, but that's words to live by as far as I'm concerned. So
true. And there's another quote that I like is, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
The luckier you get?
You're right. Yeah, I think it's Thomas Edison or Jefferson. Maybe I'm getting confused here. But yeah, the harder I work, the luckier I get, it says. It's a good one. Very good, Dr. Johnson. It's been a joy talking to you. Appreciate your insights today on water quality, zinc on sows, and also life in general.
Good enough. Appreciate the opportunity and enjoy the little podcast that I don't see all of them, but I try to see a lot of them. So I always learn something.
Very good. Imagine if with a few key concepts, you could have the potential to create a massive positive impact by bringing from hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars for swine producers. Join this small group and go to the next level of swine nutrition on the 7-week long elite online training in applied swine nutrition and feeding. It's conducted by myself, Dr. Marcio Gonçalves, and my world-class invited speakers. Additionally, you enjoy an exclusive community to exchange ideas. Go now to www.eliteswinenutritionist.com.